where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, theology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth. And when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence with Prince, Don Nikoloff.
Good evening, everyone. This is Don Nikoloff, host of Evident Footprints. It's December 29th, Saturday on the East Coast of the United States, and December 28th on the West Coast. And as usual, in between, figure out for yourself. So nice to be back here. Glad you could join us. I want to do a quick shout-out to a bunch of people before we get into tonight's show. We're going to be rolling along, and we have a regular guest with us tonight, who I'll introduce in a moment. Before we do that, I would like to do a shout-out to Karen, Bob, and Bill, David, Sheila, Crenshaw, Zachariah, and Jill, the General, and some new listeners, John in California, Marianne in Arkansas, Michael and Michael in New York, Ed in, this is New Jersey. And also, we have my buddy Vance, who is traveling around the country. Usually, he's listening out of Florida. The audience is expanding, and we have three new young listeners who I want to say hello to this evening. And that is Jordan, Dylan, and Blake. And no, it is not Michael Jordan, Bob Dylan, and Robert Blake. These are their first names, and I haven't met them yet, but I hear they're becoming big fans, so I'm happy to give them a shout-out. I'd like to thank Don and Seth at BBS Radio for the hard work they're doing in getting all the archives together and all the audio glitches. I call on in to the show on Skype, and because of that, sometimes we have technical difficulties, and they've been dissolving all the issues little by little, and the show should sound better and better as time goes on. So we appreciate your patience, listening audience. Getting down to business, I have been receiving a lot of phone calls and emails with people asking me my take on some current events, many of which I mentioned yesterday. In fact, I spoke about four anomalies in the press throughout my show yesterday. It was a rant show. And I was specifically asked my take, even though I quite clearly stated it last night, on the Bhutto assassination in Pakistan. Benazir Bhutto, who was the former prime minister of Pakistan, was murdered along with, and I guess the appropriate word would be assassinated, along with some 21 other people in a bombing. And immediately, my impression was that the powers that be around the world were just trying to foment more chaos, and it was ordered outside. Now, I heard today that Al-Qaeda was blamed, and we know that Al-Qaeda is a CIA creation, so we could assume by transitive property that quite possibly the CIA was involved. I have no proof of that, but it stinks to high heaven. And I did draw attention to something in my monologue last night, and it bears repeating. And since we have this incredible presidential candidacy going on, this campaign, this parade of characters, both on the Republican and the Democratic side, and of course, understand that that paradigm is there to create division amongst the people. We need to start thinking as Americans. We are Americans, and stop identifying so much with political parties, particularly due to the corruption in the political parties. I witnessed, when I had heard about this through my travels on the web yesterday afternoon, I had turned the television on for 5 minutes or so and got this basic scoop. They were running it nonstop on all the news networks, and they were doing this Bhutto story also on CNN. and they began interviewing the candidates, and they interviewed John McCain, and he's pushing for war, and you know, that's his mantra. And then they interviewed Mike Huckabee, and I caught something that he said that was quite disturbing and bears drawing attention and bears discussion and further analysis by anyone out there who's really paying attention, anyone in the media that's paying attention to what's going on. And I guess I'm speaking more about the alternative media, which is primarily on the internet and a few printed publications, newspapers or magazines. That when Huckabee was asked his impressions about the assassination, he offered heartfelt sympathy for the families, and I'm sort of paraphrasing that, but what he specifically says or said was, "And we apologize for what happened." Now, I thought it was a strange word to use, because usually when someone passes away, whether they're murdered or they die of natural causes or they die of an accident, and I mean a real accident, not a staged accident, usually you extend your condolences, you extend your sympathy to the family members and friends, close friends of the victim. And I thought it was unusual to say, "We apologize for what happened." And I looked up the word apologize, and it says, "Express regret for something that one has done wrong." And so it seemed to me that the statement, "We apologize," was definitely a Freudian slip, and that Huckabee shouldn't have said it, but he did. And he should be pressed on that, and it should be delved into on all levels. And I'll leave my point at that. But my intuition, my feeling, my discernment was supported by his statement. That, and I'll leave it there. With that said, I'd like to now bring tonight's guest on. He's a weekly guest, scientist, inventor, author, lecturer, teacher, and becoming quite well-known and well-loved amongst not only my listeners, but the people that visit my website, directlightproductions.com. And his name is Jim Murray. Jim, how are you tonight?
Pretty good, Don. Pretty good. Good to be back with you, as usual.
Well, you got to hear a little bit about what I said, and I don't really want to harp on that during your show tonight, but I felt it required a little bit more attention. I know these things really get your craw as well.
Well, I really do, and as you so accurately pointed out, we could go down on that tangent and spend the whole show on it, and would only be a drop in the bucket, so we'll have to save that for another time, I guess.
Yes. Now, for the sake of our listeners, Jim, who are most likely listening on the Internet, unless they're picked up by one of our AM-FM affiliates, my website now features a science page, which I was able to post yesterday. And the pictures that you had sent me of your dual synchronous capacitor are now posted on the site. So I invite anyone who's listening to go to directlightproductions.com. That includes the NSA, too. You'll get a kick out of these pictures, because we've got some 20 pictures of a really fine invention that Jim constructed for Bethlehem Steel. It saved a lot of money in electrical expenses for the company. And there's some pictures of Jim and Gene Carini and the hangar in which a flying saucer was constructed. And there are a few pictures of the saucer as well. I'm hoping Jim sends me more, actually, if he's got more. But the pictures are really nice, and there's a little explanation, little subtitles under each picture, so you know what you're looking at. And I encourage everyone to go there and take a look at that, because these are really rare pictures. This technology that he put up at Bethlehem Steel really is complex in a lot of ways, and I'm sure it took a lot of effort to construct all those components. And we're going to be talking about Jim's inventions tonight, which we have been doing for the past couple of weeks. We're going to pick up with that right now. So, Jim,
okay, Don,
the floor is yours.
I'm ready to go. I guess we should probably backtrack just a little bit. I think we left off last week on the subject of energy resonance, and I had given some examples of how that phenomenon was made use of by Nikola Tesla. And one of the ones which always raises eyebrows is the great earthquake experiment in New York City. And it's actually on record, as you pointed out last week, that that there was a real earthquake. I forget how high Richter scale, but it was big enough that it moved furniture around and broke a lot of windows and stuff like that. And the police seemed to know exactly where to go to find the epicenter, and that was in Tesla's laboratory. And when they opened the door and walked in, he was smashing the device with a sledgehammer. The thing that's interesting about that whole episode is I'm very familiar with that machine, and I have built oscillators of a similar nature, although not quite as vigorous. And you don't have to smash it with a sledgehammer to turn it off. All you have to do is disconnect the compressed air supply. And so I've always wondered about that. Maybe his real concern when he heard the police arriving was that the device would be confiscated and wind up in the wrong hands. So he decided to turn it off in a way that would prevent it from being turned back on again. But the important thing to understand here is that energy resonance is entirely different from frequency resonance, although the two, of course, are related. Frequency resonance can be looked upon as the optimization of a at a given frequency by the adjustment of all associated parameters, and this results in a peak or a sudden increase in the amplitude of the current that's flowing in the circuit when the resonance mode is struck. In a similar way, if you optimize a system, whether it be mechanical or electrical, for the accumulation of the energy that it's using as opposed to just the current, then what happens is that you reach a position where the thing is functioning so perfectly that the energy accrues linearly with respect to the passage of time, and the power requirements to cause these conditions to persist becomes minimized and also becomes constant. And that's exactly what occurred that night when I did the experiment on Drummond Island with the synchronous capacitor plant and the detour generating station across the river. So with that said, I think we had entered into description of Tesla's true wireless situation, which of course depended on energy resonance and also the controlled resonance of the entire Earth from an electrical point of view. And we're about to describe the fact that true wireless does not mean radio. Unfortunately, the term wireless has become synonymous with radio, especially in modern times where we're talking about, you know, wireless internet connections and wireless microphones and all this type of stuff. Those types of devices are radio links, essentially, that allow the operator to have freedom without being tethered by a cable. But in Tesla's day, wireless meant not using wires, but it didn't necessarily mean not using conductors. And the best example of that is the fact that he used the entire globe as a conductor for his huge movements of current, and under these controlled conditions put the planet into a state of resonance whereby he anticipated that the people who subscribe to this service would eventually be able to receive electrical power by simply having a receiver connected to a ground rod and just tune in to the proper resonant frequency and get your power right out of the ground. Now, of course, there are those who were very concerned about this type of an arrangement simply because they didn't have the intelligence or the imagination to realize how they would send a bill to people who decided to tap into this particular arrangement. And so J.P. Morgan and other people of his ilk decided that the Earth didn't need this type of an arrangement, and they made sure that Tesla was bankrupt to the point where he couldn't pull it off. And that's about where we stopped last time, if I remember correctly, Don. Do you have anything to add to that?
Well, yes, I'm glad you offered me that opportunity. I do have a question, and I'm what came to mind when you mentioned that, and you and I have discussed this to some extent in the past on other shows. The Prodigal Genius, the book that John O'Neill wrote, there is sort of an allusion to the fact that, not illusion, allusion, in other words, that Tesla had made a statement to the effect that he failed at this, and it really wasn't because of J.P. Morgan pulling, you know, this project out from underneath him, sort of like a rug or a tablecloth from underneath the place settings at the dinner table. I was wondering about your take, because my take on based upon my research, and I did quite a bit of research before I did my big, you know, article that had a big portion about Tesla's technologies and the banks stealing it, and you know, definitely the Rockefellers were involved, and probably J.P. Morgan. The central bankers most likely were involved. As you well know, when you tried to get your Dynaflux on the market, you know, you were dealing with skull and bones people. And their interest was not giving you the money. It was skimming off the top and the bottom in the middle, to put it bluntly. So you're basically confirming my conviction that Tesla darn well knew what he was doing, and it wasn't a question of him failing at it and taking the blame for the project ending, but it was that Morgan could not meter the power, or hadn't even considered how he would do that, and just decided, well, if it's going to be free, we're not going to do it.
Well, that's certainly true, but I think the overall picture is a lot more complicated, because when you really analyze what was going on, the Wardenclyffe Station on Long Island was not designed to transmit power on a global basis. It was actually designed as the World Communications Center, which would provide radio on an enormous number of channels, telephone, telegraph, facsimile, and any other signal that you know, would have interest in the commercial sense, like perhaps ticker tape readings from Wall Street and all this kind of stuff. And that would be transmitted worldwide simultaneously from one device, which was his magnifying transmitter. And the interesting thing is, Don, that the magnifying transmitter, when used for that type of purpose, is geared in such a way that it produces a continuous wave type of operation. Whereas when you're transmitting electrical power, it's actually run in a pulsed mode under a completely different set of circumstances. And those are the ones that he was investigating in Colorado Springs when he left New York for about a year, year and a half, to engage in those particular experiments. So if you really dig into it, what's interesting is that Morgan gave Tesla, I think it was $150,000 to start the Wardenclyffe Project. And at the same time that he did that, he was also finagling to arrange for Marconi to receive a patent on his radio process after he demonstrated that he could send a signal across the English Channel and have it received successfully in France or in England. I forget which side he sent it from. And if you look into it carefully, Morgan was hedging his bets. He was funding Tesla on the one side, even though he was very concerned about working with the guy because he realized he couldn't control him very well. And on the other side, he was looking for a way to get in bed with Marconi. And, of course, his intention either way was to eventually control all the radio rights, no matter what he had to do to accomplish that fact. And as it turned out, Marconi's device, which was very, very simple compared to what Tesla was offering, was functional long before Tesla's apparatus was finished. And so when that became evident, Morgan put into motion the necessary wheels, and no doubt they were well greased, to allow the patent office to suddenly issue to Marconi some fundamental radio patents. And this is very interesting because you can check the history of this entire situation, and the same exact patent applications by Marconi had been unceremoniously rejected quite a few times previously because of existing prior art by Tesla. But all of a sudden, with the proper urging from the right directions, the patent was suddenly allowed. And at the time that the patent was allowed, all of a sudden, Morgan also discontinued support of the Wardenclyffe project. And Tesla at the time couldn't believe that Morgan would just abandon that situation because he had invested $150,000, which back around 1900 was still a considerable sum of money. And so his belief was that Morgan would eventually find a way to resurrect the project and recoup his investment. But Tesla just didn't understand the magnitude of the money that was involved and the foresight that these people have when they decide to do something. That $150,000 was simply sacrificial. Morgan couldn't have cared less about it. He just looked at it as a price of doing business. Mm-hmm. And so, as you well know, he eventually set up a General Electric Corporation and RCA Corporation and all the necessary corporate structures to eventually allow him control of the emerging science of radio. And Tesla was left out in the cold, as usual.
It bears pointing out to the listeners that eventually Tesla was awarded the patent and given credit for inventing the radio, however, some years later.
Well, he already had patents that were issued, but what was unfortunate about it was due to the massaging of the media, people honestly began to believe that Marconi was the inventor of radio. And that whole thing went to court, and by the time it was ironed out and they said, oh, yeah, Tesla's the true inventor of radio, the poor guy was already dead, so it was posthumously awarded, which didn't do him a lot of good.
Yeah. Jim, I had one more question in regard to the nature of the wireless, and this is in relation to what we know or some other wireless technologies that we have today. Of course, we have infrared, which is wireless, but it's totally dependent upon an optical transmitter and receiver. In other words, you have to be in range and aiming a light-emitting diode, even though it's infrared in nature, towards the receiver to cause the communication. What I was wondering is if possibly Tesla hadn't already delved into what we call UHF, or ultra-high frequency type of transmission, because we do have also UHF remote controls and UHF type of wireless devices.
Well, to answer your question, Don, Tesla had dedicated his entire life to the study of all frequencies having to do with electrical and electromagnetic effects. And so if you read his journals very carefully, you'll see that he did delve into ultra-high frequencies. But frankly, even though he's the inventor of radio and made use of its properties for a number of different reasons, he really thought that the invention of it was a monstrosity. And he said that in his own words, because he literally looked upon everything that he did only from the standpoint of its ultimate efficiency. And radio, per se, in his opinion, is probably the most inefficient device, popularly embraced device in the world. And the reason for that is that when you get the antenna into the proper mode of resonance so that your signal is literally propagating, it goes out in a hemispherical pattern all over the place until it's so far away that it can't be received. And then the individual receivers are picking up some tiny, 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 almost insignificant disturbance, which is, of course, an exact replica of what's transmitted in so far as the information content is concerned, but negligible amount of power. And that signal isn't even used in the radio. Literally, it is a blueprint which allows the receiver, the discriminating circuits and the detecting circuits and the amplifying circuits in the receiver, to literally construct a much larger signal from a power supply that's associated with the radio itself before you can essentially enjoy the reception of the program. So in reality, what is transmitted from the transmitter to a given receiver has an efficiency rating that's probably so low it's not worth calculating. Now, even though Tesla was the inventor of it, he thought it was a horrendously inefficient device, and he couldn't understand people's preoccupation with radio, you know, because of its so-called wireless ability. But the true wireless that Tesla was all excited about is really an expansion on the idea of a single circuit, a single wire circuit. And I don't know if there are any electrical folks out there listening, but the current approach, no pun intended, to the electrical transmission idea in our technology today is essentially a DC circuit with AC disturbances superimposed upon the original DC circuit. And even AC has been treated in such a way that it essentially mirrors DC in its behavior. I mean, the equivalent heat capacity of a DC current flowing has been calculated and associated with the RMS value of an AC wave. And the average value of the power that's sent is essentially mimicking DC. And so is the fact that you have a sending wire and a return wire. But as Tesla tried to point out to people, even though he introduced that system himself, he went on to graduate to greater things. And because AC doesn't go anywhere, it simply sloshes back and forth, you don't need two wires to make use of its power capabilities. And so Tesla eventually started working with single-wire circuits in which you had a transmitter on one end joined to a receiver somewhere down the line by only one wire. And there was no ground involved either, unless you look at it from the standpoint that the wire itself was the ground. But actually it wasn't, because he was making use of what we call a virtual ground, which is essentially at a higher potential than most grounds are. And the fact of the matter is that he could transmit this electricity back and forth at extremely high rates of efficiency, and he did so with only one wire. So once he had accomplished this and perfected it to the point where he knew how to achieve this result anytime he cared to, the next step was to eliminate the wire. And he did that by simply putting the transmitter, the high side, if you want to call it that, of the transmitter into the ground and using the earth as the single wire. And of course, this required a much more powerful machine than would be required to send power down one piece of wire between, you know, let's say two buildings or somewhere local, because he's energizing the entire globe. And that was the reason why he had to get out of New York City to try this and set up a completely different laboratory in Colorado Springs, way out in the country where he didn't bother anybody. And that was the place where he did all of his experiments with one-wire transmission, no-wire transmission or true wireless, and even went to the point of starting to capture electrical power out of the atmosphere and transmitting it into the earth. So, you know, there's actually a whole lot more to the concept than what people normally think. And these folks who build Tesla coils for their science experiments and science fair projects and just simply blast sparks out all over the place, they are not really imitating what Tesla was doing. They just think they are.
Yeah.
Because his device was far more complex.
Keeping that in mind, I don't intend to go off on a tangent here, but what I'm recalling is also Tesla's statements that he made, that he was making contact with, you know, via his radio transmissions with, let's say, beings out there in space, and he referred to Mars. What is very interesting, and I myself, you've heard me say this on some shows, that I intuit that we have been on Mars since the 1960s, possibly as early as 1962, despite the fact that they promoted a moon landing in 1969. We were already up on Mars. In fact, the general story coming out with some very recent evidence, and I'm speaking about as recent as today, in an interview between Bill Ryan, Kerry Cassidy, and their interviewee, David Wilcock, they were speaking about wormholes and what are called jump gates. This is the technology that they're using. It's an alien technology that they can instantly transport themselves to places like Mars and virtually any other location they choose. It's totally in line with what Tesla was talking about. And in fact, they talk about the fact that there is not just life on Mars, but that there are several colonies up there that we have and have had for a number of years, close to, or at least 30 years, we've had some colonies up there, and they have preparations going on there. Now, that adds a whole lot of credibility to the claims that Tesla made. In fact, it implies that they used his technology to accomplish this to some extent. Any comment about that?
Well, I'm not as up on these latest developments as you are, but one thing that I am very, very sure of, and that is that in long past, and I'm talking like maybe 18,000 years ago, when Atlantis was still in existence on Earth, that there was definitely commerce between Earth and Mars. And that one of the things that's really impressive about that, I don't remember the name of the that was used, but Cairo had also an Arabic name, And that Arabic name, when translated, is a direct translation of the word Mars. And what's interesting about it is that there's pyramid complex has been seen on Mars, and of course this pyramid complex in lots of places on Earth, but the most famous one is the Giza complex. And it just seems absolutely possible, in my view, that there might have been some lingering civilization still there, or perhaps the disturbances that he was setting up were reaching someplace else. But he definitely did say that he had reached somebody, because he was getting back intelligence signals that he was trying to decode, and they were not echoes or any kind of redundant resonant effects, which he had studied thoroughly, because lightning actually causes that exact phenomenon, and he was well familiar with that. So the interesting thing is, when he made that statement about having received some strange signals from somewhere, he didn't actually, I don't think he was the one who actually said that they came from Mars, but I think the statement that he actually made was, Mars is now closest to the Earth, you know, in its orbit. And then the media picked it up and went with it from there. I don't remember exactly. But needless to say, there was a lot of commotion over that. And after the event, Tesla was strangely quiet. He didn't choose to elaborate one way or the other, which, of course, doesn't help us trying to unravel the thing at this point.
Yeah, well, for anyone out there, including you, Jim, if you're interested, I urge you to go to ProjectCamelot.org and listen to some of the more recent interviews that Bill Ryan and Kerry Cassidy have produced with Dr. Dan Burrish and David Wilcock. They are quite revealing. These are multiple series videos. They're in like three or four parts each. And there's a lot of technological information exchanged in these interviews. And that'll catch you up to date on what has been said. Now, interestingly, and I just throw this out there, you know, when I had Bill Ryan and Kerry Cassidy on my show, some 6 months ago, they had asked me what my take was as far as what was going on Mars. And I said, I just know that we have people up there. I know that there's life up there. I know that there is green vegetation, that there is blue water, that there is air, there's an atmosphere that's breathable, and there is animal life. And that has been confirmed in some of these interviews. Now, these are people, and it's not limited to just the people that I named. There are some other people that have been working on these projects. They've worked on the Montauk project or the Philadelphia experiment and a lot of projects with NASA. Basically, they have just presented that what's going on and the level of technology that we actually have in our hands is bordering on incredible. It's there, so you have to know that it exists. But it's nice to get confirmation like that, because I don't just make this stuff up, and neither did Tesla. And I'm not comparing myself to Tesla when I say that. But there was definitely the employment of intuition in his work and how he conceived of his inventions and how he made them work. And it bears repeating.
Well, I go along with that. I mean, I think Tesla was highly intuitive, and he was actually very spiritual as well. The problem is that most people who delve into that aspect of his life fail to reckon with the fact that just because he didn't subscribe to any organized religion does not mean that he didn't love and respect the deity. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with taking that approach. If you want to learn about God on a one-to-one basis as opposed to being funneled through an existing organization, I think that's a personal decision. And I think that's the kind of decision he made. But to get into that whole thing would be another program.
or several.
Anyhow, getting back to what we were discussing, one of the things that's really incredible about this whole deal with the radio is that, and we mentioned this somewhere in the past, that when RCA was eventually formed using the patents obtained by Morgan through the inventions of Marconi rather than Tesla's, one of the stations that was put into operation around the time of World War I was the transatlantic transmitting facility in New Brunswick, New Jersey, which was unfortunately torn down, you know, years ago. But I, having lived in New Jersey for many years, went to see the spot where it used to be. And it's a very interesting story behind it, because when the thing was eventually reopened after the war for commercial purposes, Tesla was actually invited to the proceedings, and so was Steinmetz, and so was Albert Einstein. And Tesla declined. He just decided not to go. And it's very, very peculiar, but if you dig into it, the whole purpose of that deal was to encourage some sort of a debate between Einstein and Tesla. And when Tesla didn't go, he actually kind of shot himself in the foot, because the associated articles about the phenomenon suggested that Tesla had lost by default. And the discussion, of course, was going to be the relationship between electromagnetic radiation and the Einsteinian theory of relativity. And that was a very, very sore spot for Nikola Tesla, because Tesla embraced the relativity concepts that were discovered and written about by Boskovic, who was actually another Serb, and who had lived years before Tesla, and he is famous for having written 1,000 volumes on natural philosophy, some of which included the precepts of relativity, the possible exchange between mass and energy, and a whole barrage of other concepts which have only recently come into popularity in scientific circles. He had written about 100 years before Tesla. And the interesting thing about Boskovic is that in those days, when you were referred to as a natural philosopher, that was, for all intents and purposes, an alchemist. And Boskovic associated with such people, or at least he was in the same circles as people like Leibniz and Newton and those type of people, and Newton was very definitely an alchemist. So it's really kind of interesting to see that a lot of this information that came down the pipe through unorthodox channels wound up being the cornerstone of some of Tesla's thinking, and actually also Einstein's thinking. Because it's very, very probable that Einstein obtained copies of Boskovic's work when he was acting as an examiner for the Swiss Patent Office during his younger years, and was completely enamored by the concepts of relativity, but wound up altering them to suit his own purposes, and wound up changing the entire world and securing for himself a great position of prominence. Whereas Tesla, who embraced Boscovich's concepts, which make use of non-Newtonian reference frames and, you know, angular velocities associated with masses moving in space rather than just translational motion, was left in the dust. But what's really interesting about the whole thing is that when Einstein started to really gain momentum and popularity because of his theory of relativity and all of the things that it could do, the idea of the curvature of space-time, which is a four-dimensional space concept, and the fact that gravity is nothing more than a centrifugal force applied in four dimensions, that just curled the hair on Tesla's head. And he threatened to publish a dynamic theory of gravity, which would essentially debunk the entire Einsteinian concept of relativity, because Tesla claimed that he understood exactly what gravity was, and it had nothing to do with the space-time curvature, but rather with the production of a force which he himself had investigated and understood thoroughly. And he threatened to publish what he called his dynamic theory of gravity. And this was sometime around the 1920s. And it made quite a splash. It got into the newspapers and whatnot. But interestingly enough, Tesla never followed through on it. And so that leaves us wondering, you know, why he made so much noise in the first place, and then what dissuaded him from actually giving more information to the public. I mean, he just went absolutely silent on the whole concept. And one of the things that has always bothered me about the whole issue is whatever became of that information, whatever became of the dynamic theory of gravity, and what did Tesla actually know in this field that he didn't tell anyone? Now, we get some interesting hints about that in some of the more obscure writings that Tesla was responsible for producing, particularly those articles that he prepared for his birthday interviews, in which he always made predictions about the future and talked about inventions that he was someday going to reveal and this type of thing. On one of those occasions, he described very thoroughly a new type of airship that would not be an airplane, had no wings, had no propeller, could levitate directly off the planet without any visible sign of propulsion, and could hover motionless in the sky or move at incredible speeds. And he went on to say that this was a brainchild of his that he had taken many, many years to understand and develop, and that most probably his first prototypes would be powered by his turbine, which is very interesting, because you would never suspect that a device like that would be propelled by a turbine. But that was one of the things he sort of suggested. And the reason why I find that rather exciting, Don, is because his turbine makes use of vortexial motion. And all the ancient writings that refer to spacecraft of an earlier era all claim that they made use of a vortex to suspend themselves in imitation of the forces the planets themselves produce. And we all know, or at least some of us do, that Tesla was well read in the Vedic philosophies and had gone through a number of translations of such documents as the Mahabharata and some of the other epic tales from India, which describe not only a war between Atlantis and India, but also technologies that existed in those days. So, you know, the entire story takes on an incredible complexity and diversity that's far removed from what John O'Neill had to say in Prodigal Genius.
Yeah, Jim, you're bringing something to mind too in your discussion here or your mention of Atlantis. To your knowledge, did Tesla ever talk about the civilization of Lemuria? I tend to deduce that that was a very holistic society, and that the technology and the consciousness were of a very high nature, and what Tesla basically was doing was returning this civilization back to that that level of consciousness, although the powers that be, which is probably the answer to your statement about where these inventions disappeared or why he was so quiet about what he was doing, because he came to experience and to know that they were going to try to weaponize virtually everything that he invented.
Yeah, well, I frankly have never heard him make mention of anything of that sort, but it just seems to me that a guy who is fluent in seven or eight languages and read voraciously on almost every topic, from poetry to astronomy, would have not been aware of the existing writings concerning places like Atlantis and Lemuria. But even if he wasn't aware of it for some reason, I think that his imagination was such, and the knowledge he did have was such, that his consciousness might have just inadvertently tapped into the Akashic record and pulled some of that information forward, which, of course, as you know, is part of the creative process for anyone who's capable of making use of it at that level. And so he may have pulled that information out of the ether and offered it to mankind, whether he was conscious of the fact that he was doing so or not. But needless to say, he was cut off at the knees, as they say, and he didn't get to fulfill his entire mission, which is unfortunate for us.
Yeah, I would surmise that Tesla was an ET, and a lot of other people would too. I think the man was absolutely.
Well, books written in that vein. Unfortunately, they were so pathetically composed that they're very difficult to read. I managed to get through a couple of them. The one I remember the best was something about a dove. I forget the exact title of it. And it was written by a lady named Margaret somebody or another. But it was pretty bad. I mean, you know, if you're going to write something on a subject that obtuse, you better make sure you have your facts straight, and you should also have an ungodly volume of references and supporting data, because a claim like that needs unbelievable amount of support if it's ever going to be accepted.
But anyway,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just agreeing with you. That's very true. Jim, we're about out of time here. Any closing remarks until we pick up again next week?
Yeah, I think one thing I would like to end with, Don, would just be to reiterate that my own investigations over approximately a 40-year period definitely seem to indicate that Tesla may have attempted to transmit some of his more obscure information to the future generations by means of unorthodox channels. And that brings into view the whole situation with people like Otis Carr and Gene Carini and Warren Getz and all that crowd. And that might be worth touching on the next time we speak.
Okay. What's the chance of me getting some more photos, if you have any more, of that craft? Is there any possibility of that? Or?
Well, actually, I don't have any more photos of the craft, because in those days when I was working up there, I was very restricted in what I could photograph and what I couldn't. I managed to get the ones that I sent you. However, I do have a fairly sizable collection of other photographs that relate to that same time period. Some are here with me in Oklahoma, and others are in New Jersey. But I will rummage through my collection and see what I can find that would be relevant, and I'll be happy to send them to you.
Okay, I'd appreciate that. And already, I want you to know we're getting real positive feedback about the birth of my science page on my website.
Well, good. I'll see if I can supply you with some articles as well if you're interested.
Yeah, and I'm anxious for your book to come out, because we'll be able to sell it on the site, and I'm sure BBS will help us out too.
Well, I'm working on it as fast as I can. That's all I can say.
Okay, folks, you've been listening to Evident Footprints, and our special guest this evening was none other than Jim Murray, and Jim will be back with us again next week. We want to make sure you tune in. In the meantime, we are coming up upon soon New Year's. Next week we've got some great guests coming on board the show, so please make sure you come back and pay us a visit. I want to thank you all for listening in. I hope you all had a wonderful Christmas. Don't get crazy over the weekend with New Year's coming up here. And I want to wish everybody Happy New Year in case you're not able to tune in early next week. In the meantime, peace, love, and light, and we'll see you all later on.